Hello, everybody, and welcome to this Institute for Government general election event. Today, we're looking at what makes a successful election comms strategy. I'm Jill Rutter, and I'm substituting for Catherine Haddon today. So sometime this year, we'll have parties all vying to convince voters to support them. And communications will be an absolute critical part of what they're doing, as well as the way in which our media cover the election. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. We're going to discuss what makes a successful strategy. And to do that, I'm delighted to be joined by two people who can claim to have run successful campaigns. Lee Kane, Downing Street Director of Communications, 2019 to 2020, Comms Director during the 2019 general election, but also Comms Director for Vote Leave.
Head of Broadcast for Vote Leave. There were more experienced people.
Head of Broadcast for Vote Leave. A key player in the Vote Leave communications strategy. So you can chalk up two successful campaigns there. On my left, James Schneider. James was Head of Strategic Communications for the Labour Party from 2016 to 2020. So James can claim, I think, success in 2017, but perhaps slightly less so in 2019. So we'll be discussing that with James. And then I'm delighted to be joined as well by two people who've had to make sense of what's going on for the general public. On my far right, I've got Anushka Astana, Deputy Political Editor of ITV News, about to rush off to cover Prime Minister's questions and then tune in to Peston tonight. And then on my far left, Katie Searle. Katie was head of BBC Westminster 2017 to 2020 and executive editor of BBC Politics. With the exception of Anushka, they've all moved on to do other things now, but we're going to concentrate on their roles in these campaigns and in those roles now. So look up their bios and do engage them if you want to use them in their new roles. Anyway, how are we going to do this? If you are watching online, you can post questions on Slido. You can also do that if you're in the room. Please upvote that question that's not quite as good as the one you would have asked, but is pretty similar, so I know what you really, really want to know. We'll also take questions in the room. So the format's going to be that I'm going to chat for a little bit, and then we'll have lots and lots of time for questions from all of you. So let's get going. Lee, talk to us about how you sort of went about shaping the strategy for 2019. Had you basically started planning the moment you set foot inside Downing Street that you were going to have to get a general election?
So I think, you know, when we look back at July 2019, when we first went into number 10, there was obviously a huge uncertainty surrounding Brexit. I think at that particular time, you know, people had become overwhelmingly fed up and fatigued with the constant back and forth and no progress that had happened over those years. So it was clear that, you know, at some point there was going to be a general election. I don't think we knew when. And that election was going to be framed around the issue predominantly of Brexit. So I think we knew from when we walked through the door that where we had to position Boris at that point is, you know, Boris was the change candidate in this. He was going to be very different to Theresa May and David Cameron and be a sort of different kind of Conservative Party. And the core thing that he was going to be the guy to remove the blockers that people had been frustrated about, that had seen Brexit, you know, fail, I mean, what they'd voted for, not be pulled in. And that was a gateway to deliver what people really wanted, which was, you know, their priorities of public services, of, you know, NHS reform, tougher on crime, better education, those sort of core elements. That's what actually people wanted. So we had to fix the logjam. So we started campaigning on day one. And by this, you know, we looked at straight away trying to differentiate Boris to what had gone before. So if you turned on the 6 o'clock news, top of that, you know, hour would be, you know, Dominic Grieve and, you know, whoever else sort of, you know, shouting at each other, and what the public see is just a, you know, zoo of arguments and everything else. We'd have Boris out at a hospital talking about, you know, hey, we're going to get Brexit done, and then we're going to move on to your priorities, which is here, you know, and our, whatever our plan, particularly that day announcement, would be at the NHS. Consistently, he would be out and he would be where people's priorities were. And I think that was a sort of key thing. If you're watching The Six, even with the volume off, while all the Westminster noise was talking about what was happening in Parliament, Boris was out, hospitals, schools, you know, police stations, wherever it may be, with announcement looking at how we're going to fix for you. But to get there, we obviously had to earn the right to show that actually he was serious and different to what had gone before. So the period before the election was about differentiating him. So, you know, we get on things like removing the whip from the Tory MPs, prorogation arguments, all those things that shown he'd done everything he can before we got to an election. And I think, in essence, that meant that by the time an election was called, we'd probably already won it. I think it was almost impossible for the Labour Party at that point to actually regain the territory that had lost in that period.
And had you already worked out that get Brexit done, which I think is a brilliant slogan, in terms of capturing the zeitgeist of Brexit all done, building that coalition, had you worked out from the get-go that that was going to be your slogan? Or, you know, you could have actually, you know, potentially rammed your withdrawal agreement through Parliament after the votes in late October, but... it's not gone to the country in quite the same way then.
So, I think when you look at all successful political campaigns, they all start with public opinion research. You have to know what the public think about the core issues and what is motivating them, you know, in their issues. So, you know, by that, we would, all political parties are in a battle to shape public opinion. Now, you know, what we would always look to do is look at, you know, what to say, how to say it, and who to say it to, in terms of messaging, in order to frame the arguments in a way that would convince as many people as possible that the moral story we were trying to tell was the one they should vote for, as opposed to the story that James is trying to tell. And that's the sort of constant friction point. So we knew very early what, you know, we're developing what that moral story is, and that was a constant evolution as we're going through. And that's, you know, that's why, you know, I'd be ringing up Katie most days arguing about what's on the top of the 10, because I want people to hear our moral story, our framing. And James is probably on the other side, giving the actual counter-argument, and poor Katie's probably got a terrible job listening to us both complain to her. But that's the sort of ball game at that point.
OK, well, let's go over to James. James, you ran two campaigns as Director of Communications in the Labour Party. 2017, surprise election. So interested to know what planning you were doing and how you, you know, managed to communications then. So what went right in 2017 and what went sort of less right, let's put it that way, in 2019 for you?
So step back about 3 weeks from when Theresa May called the election in 2017 and things were going very badly for us. We were 20 points behind in the polls, give or take, and really, really struggling to get our message out at all. And the local election campaign was beginning. So we made a decision then to start with a policy blitz to try to get out what we were about and what our message was. So in the, I think it was the 18 or 16 days before Theresa May had called the election, we'd had 12 announcements. We'd had some of which ended up being major announcements in the election, like free school meals, like scrapping VAT on, which was paid for by scrapping VAT on private schools. And so we were sort of in a mini campaign mode, but it hadn't been worked out. Of course, we didn't know that there was going to be, we didn't know that there was going to be an election. Then as soon as it was called, we're thrown straight into it, and we hadn't prepared for the election, and in some ways that was a good thing, because most of the advice that we were getting, the sort of traditional advice from people that normally run Labour Party campaigns, was terrible. But it was fantastic to have it.
But Alistair Campbell was terrible. Was he?
Well, no, Alistair Campbell was some of the more storied members of the previous Labour comms hierarchy were more busy trying to kneecap us than provide us any advice. But some people that they had given their wisdom to were in senior positions within the party bureaucracy. And it was fantastic that we got their terrible advice because we could do the exact opposite. So they would say, you can't change the polling in an election campaign, so we must fight a very defensive campaign. We say, no, well, if they say that, we should do the opposite. We have to fight an aggressive campaign. They say, rallies don't matter at all. They're just speaking to the faithful. We go, well, no, actually, that's a very good image that is on the 6 o'clock news with the volume down, and we can build a narrative around that. they said policy doesn't matter. And we thought, well, actually, no, this is our one chance, our one way to have more interesting content than the other side and speak with our own voice. And I think that's the most important thing. There are a whole number of other factors that go into it. But when that boils down, we were able on more days than not to have our story of the day reach the people that we wanted to reach, to have our images that we wanted on the top of the news that people would see with the volume turned down. And that built up throughout the campaign. Of course, there were moments where we got great attention. There was the leaked manifesto, which meant we got 4 or 5 days of sort of scandal coverage, but scandal coverage about...
Did you leak it? Was that part of your strategy, James?
Unfortunately, I didn't leak it. I really wish I had, because it was fantastic. No, instead I got the call from Jack Blanchard saying that it had been leaked, and I wasn't delighted at the time. But it turned out fantastically. So I think, in 2017, we had the element of surprise, the controversy of the day. And I think what is the controversy of the day, and whether it's your controversy or the other side's controversy, almost regardless of whether you play it that well tactically or not, that adds up to what the campaign ends up being about. So you remember 2017, that campaign when it started, we were told this is a Brexit campaign. Sky on its ticker said this was the Brexit election. Constituencies on their map were either blue or yellow. They were coded Leave or Remain. They weren't coded Labour or Tory. But we changed what the election was about very quickly to being about the many versus the few, which was our core framing. Mm. Now, fast forward to 2019. Also, one more point to make is our main message carrier, Jeremy, spoke in his own voice. He was authentic. He was himself. And he was clearly energising lots of people. And even if people didn't like what he was saying, they could see that lots of people were being energised by what he was saying. So he was a superb message carrier, and he was so relaxed in his interviews and so on and so forth. Then by 2019, the election was only about Brexit, because in 2017, Brexit had happened. We hadn't left the EU, but Brexit had happened because everybody thought it was going to happen. The only question was, will it be a bit more like this or a bit more like that? But by 2019... the people who really wanted to leave thought, my goodness, we might not leave. And the people that really wanted to overturn that thought, my goodness, we might be able to overturn it. And that changed the whole character of not just the election campaign, but also internally within our team. So in 2017, we had a very divided team, but divided in a very good way, which was we had... I don't necessarily mean this in a moral way. We had the good people who were our close team, and we had the bad people who were the more traditional Labour bureaucrats who were opposed to us. But we were able to do quite a lot of things. We also had Momentum, who could do a lot of the ground campaign and a lot of the digital work. By 2019, we had much more control over the machine, but our own team, the good people, was internally divided, and it was internally divided on the key strategic question, which was Brexit. And that incoherence plays out throughout the campaign. You can see it at all sorts of moments. We did some things which were technically very good, I think, in the 2019 campaign, some things I'm tactically quite proud of, but overall, that fissure at the very heart of our team meant that we couldn't pursue a good strategy. Also, our main message carrier, Jeremy, had to talk about Brexit a lot, and we had a terrible position. And exactly as Lee was saying, wanting to make Boris Johnson look like the change candidate, Jeremy Corbyn, amazingly, looked more like the ordinary politician when talking about Brexit, trying to hold a line and fudge and move around, which was the polar opposite to how he was in 2017.
Really, really interesting. Anoushka, you cover these campaigns. So what are you trying to sort of achieve, and what sort of matters to you? I mean, we have this sort of, both campaigns trying to control you effectively. So to what extent are you sort of pushing back on being manipulated by by people like Lee and James into getting what they want out there on behalf of the public?
Well, it kind of depends where you're at. And I've been at a lot of different types of places. So I've covered elections at a Sunday paper, at a daily paper. I've covered elections on Rolling News, at a big broadcaster, and at a podcast. And wherever you are, they treat you very, very differently. And actually, the 2017 campaign is probably a bit different on this matter, but largely, most campaigns I've been on, broadcast is treated as king. And you get access like no other when you are a broadcaster. In the campaign, I should say, newspapers are really important to you guys as well, because that's the way that they drive stories. They often do exclusives with newspapers. But as a broadcaster, you get to be right there up against you. And they try to manipulate you in every campaign. Let me give you an example of 2015. And actually, I think ever since this campaign, it's one that we need to think about how we think about polls in every campaign since then, is that what the Conservative Party, and I was on David Cameron's bus for that campaign, so I was like 3 months following David Cameron around the country. What the Conservatives wanted to do in that campaign repeatedly, and we're seeing a bit of this now, is focus on the polls, and the polls were pointing to a hung parliament. And so every day they'd be like, oh God, we've got this great story for you, great story. And they'd give it to me and it would be literally the same story, which was, you know, look at the polls, you can have a coalition of chaos with Ed Miliband, or you can have, it wasn't strong and stable. I actually can't remember what it was. And interestingly, not 2015, I think that was 2017.
Long-term economic.
Something like that.
although,
interestingly, I just saw a little bit of polling that suggested no one can ever remember election slogans, with, I think, Get Brexit Done being the one kind of one that stands out, although I'm sure you would argue for the many, not the few, but actually people cannot see where they are linked to.
Take back control.
We're talking about general elections here. And the polls can be quite damaging, I think, to how people report, and I really, really determined, particularly since then, although we try to avoid it in that campaign as well, to allow the polls to drive the narrative. Because in driving the narrative, they change the outcome, probably. As a broadcaster, it's quite difficult, particularly if you're on a bus. You're right there with them every day, day in, day out. You are seeing the election through a certain lens. And I think it's incredibly important, and I'm sure Katie will talk about this, for the team as a whole to take a step back and make sure that that isn't in any way affecting what you see. I mean, on the flip side of it, it means you are travelling to target seats all over the country, talking to voters and hearing what they want to, you know, think about. And I thought Lee's point on this was really interesting. What we care about as broadcasters are what our viewers care about. And what our viewers care about are the same things that you're seeing in your public opinion research. And so, you know, you talk about the NHS. I think it's really interesting to see how much the NHS is actually focused on in this campaign, because it remains the thing that when I go and knock on people's doors and talk to people on streets where there are elections coming out, it remains the number one issue that I hear about and that people care about. And actually, you know, on a personal level, I had an experience in A&E last week, not for me, for my son, who is now fine. And it was really, really, it was a bad experience. And I thought to myself, how many millions of people are having this experience right now? And how is that going to impact how they vote in the next election? So I think from our point of view, it's thinking about what our viewers want to hear about. It's making sure we focus on those issues. I think once you get into a campaign, and James, you will have experienced this more than anyone else, things change quite dramatically, because as broadcasters, we give absolutely even coverage to both sides or to all sides of the campaign, and that does change the feel of it. So I think it is fair to say that Jeremy then got a much bigger platform, probably, or a fairer platform, you would argue, once the campaign began. I mean, the one thing I would say, if we're talking about comm strategy, you were up against a very bad comm strategy, and nobody can deny that that had a big impact in 2017. Although somebody, I was talking to someone about this earlier, and they said, was it comms or policy? And I was like, well, the policy was the social care plan, but the comms failure was to allow that to ever get through, because it was unsellable, and it was complacency. And that complacency to allow that to get through, I think, was hugely damaging to Theresa May, alongside a few other things. And I would also say, I'm just trying to think what one thing I started on a Sunday paper where we barely even thought about online coverage. Like, it wasn't a thing. All I cared about was I in the paper? You know, that was at The Observer. When I returned to the same company years later as The Guardian's political editor, we almost didn't care about the paper as much anymore. Actually, I shouldn't say that. We really care about papers. But what we really cared about was who's reading this online, because that's where we were getting it everywhere. The world is and has changed. You know, sound bites emerged from televisions dominating election campaigns. Nowadays, social media is completely dominant in a way that it wasn't before. I still think, by the way, that politicians rightly care a lot about the evening bulletins and the 10 o'clock bulletins, because we still have millions of eyeballs. But the world is changing. And in that social media world, there's a massive, massive fight for attention. And I think it's in that world that you start to get things like the attack ads, like the Tories' London ad, if you saw that, or from the Labour side, the... I'm going to say this wrong, but they basically accuse Rishi Sunak of letting paedophiles out of jail. It's something like that. But these attack ads that to all of us seem completely kind of shocking and kind of going to a place where we haven't seen politicians go in recent years, I think a lot of that is born out of social media, which in turn then affects both the broadcast and the print coverage.
And those, of course, the ones we see rather than the ones that are going through under the radar and things like Facebook and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think it is just worth making that point as well, which is the targeting that they are able to do now compared to the targeting they were previously. It was all about the air war, right? It was all about kind of the message you got out on a national level. Now they have such granular detail in terms of how they get to voters. It is completely changing the way that they campaign. And some people would say in a negative way, because they only focus on who they are targeting. And the 2015 campaign that I mentioned showed me an example of that, because on that bus with Cameron, we actually spent almost all our time, not in Labour, Tory marginals, but in Lib Dem seats in the Southwest. Because the way that David Cameron won a majority was basically to kill the Lib Dems. And being on a bus, you could totally see that. And it's the same thing that happened in 2010 when the air war looked very good for Nick Clegg. But when it came to it, he didn't actually win. I think he won fewer seats than expected.
So, Katie, picking up on what Anushka's been saying, how does the BBC think about, presumably your former colleagues are thinking now about how they're going to cover this? And, you know, to what extent does the BBC see a responsibility of making the election about the sort of policy choices rather than just being a sort of, you know, slightly slogan-driven, superficial personality campaign with lots of pictures? So rather than just have a picture of, you know, leader at a hospital, we're actually saying, well, do you actually have plans that in any way sort out the NHS and things like that?
Yeah, you're right. People will be sitting down and have been for some time thinking about it. And the debate around the noise and the policy is absolutely central to that. And there'll be a lot of discussion, not only in the BBC, across all the media, about how we do the proper stuff, you know, and the stuff that people care about, except when you actually look at the figures, people don't care about that much. I mean, they like to say they do, and of course we want to know what's going to happen to our hospitals, but they can't quite help listening to the fight a little bit more. So I think, you know, that is just the truth of it. And, you know, we can argue all day, but it is the truth of it. I mean, you know, in terms of actually getting to the explain, you, Lee and James both said a couple of times, 6 o'clock news with the sound off, which slightly makes me want to kind of pack up and go home. But, you know, it does say a lot about how, you know, parties see the message and the power of picture, which I think is really, really important. In television, that's all that matters, really. You know, so that's a really important thing in terms of the campaign. I mean, look, in terms of, you know, go back to the question, Jill, I think that is absolutely crucial, is how do you, as a broadcaster and the main broadcaster in the country, and whatever you say from the morning of, any election campaign, the BBC has enormous sway, and I'll talk about a little bit more about that in a minute. It's how do you get the balance right, both through the day, whether it's online or whether it's right through to the 10 o'clock news, and you don't get drawn into something that, you know, 24 hours later is just nonsense. You know, I think we should talk about social media a little bit more, because I completely agree with Anushka. I think you're certainly in 19, When I first started doing politics 10 years ago or so, you know, the news cycle, as we all know, was probably two or three a day. And by 19, I mean, it was changing by the minute. Mm. You know, Lee will remember the punch that never was, you know, which involved...
Not the proudest hour.
Which involved Matt Hancock's match not being punched, as it turned out. But that, you know, that dominated for about 48 hours and really was a kind of nothing story. But could the BBC not have covered that? Well, no, of course not. We would have had to have done that, as would ITN. See my colleagues from Sky in the audience say, you know, we would have all been sort of jumping on that. So, you know, I think that's a real tension about how to deliver to the audience actually the stuff that does really matter. Mm. Are my schools going to get more teachers? Are there going to be more doctors or maybe more hospitals, Lee, as you wanted to do? But, you know, the around the noise, and especially when you get a fight between, and do use that word advisedly, a fight between characters like Johnson and Corbyn, who are become very, very big figures within a campaign and dominate that so hugely. So how do you make that judgment? And, it's not easy, except you probably are going to do a division, which is the kind of noise and the detail. And in the end, it becomes a formula.
And so, Katie, one of the things, we've got questions coming in online. Is that from Anonymous? Lots of these questions are from Anonymous. Hi, Anonymous. About whether, you know, sit-down interviews. There was a lot of controversy in 2019. Jeremy Corbyn turned up for Andrew Neil. Boris Johnson didn't leave. Giggling there. Boris Johnson didn't turn up for the debates. We had, you know, as many of us, first time we ever saw Rishi Sunak in action, those of us
just
that
to clarify,
switched
he
on.
Did turn up for the debates, he just didn't, we didn't do a head-to-head.
You didn't do the head-to-head?
We didn't we didn't do the Andrew Neil interview, but we did the debate and we did the question
time
thing.
You did the question time thing.
You did the debate.
All right, okay.
More interviews in that campaign than anyone's ever done before. Just to
do we think that those are sort of important moments? Should there be sort of, you know, ground rules, expectations?
I think they're enormously important. And right now, there will be discussions within all the broadcasters about how they're going to get the head-to-head. And to be clear, the head-to-head is the only thing that matters, right, out of all of them. The others are definitely nice to haves. And again, I can say this now.
So the head-to-head is what?
Is the two principles. We had Johnson and Corbyn, and that was the prize. And I think I'm saying it was the first time there'd been a two-header in a head-to-head debate. And that was, you know, a hard-fought agreement that I negotiated on behalf of the BBC with Lee and wasn't you, James, directly, but it was one of your colleagues. And it was a slow process because actually for the BBC particularly, there's a lot of balancing out, if you like. So we did a seven header as well, which includes all the other parties. And that is for impartiality, quite rightly. Is there an expectation within the broadcasters that everyone's going to go, "Way, let's watch that great seven-header debate"? I would say no. In terms of the sit-down interviews that you said, I think there's still a really important place for long-form interviews. There is also a separate point that the media has changed enormously. And back 10, 15 years ago, those sit-down interviews were an incredibly important moment for the audience to get to a detailed point on policy. Now the media is so different that there are many, many, many more of these opportunities. So I would say the challenge actually for companies like my former employer is to how to make sure that they, by the time they get to them, if they do them, they haven't already done 20 before, so why would I bother watching? So, and that is, you know, it's an important kind of democratic point, actually, because, you know, to go back to your point about policy, we've got to make sure those long-form interviews exist so you can spend 20, 30, 40 minutes really, really, really drilling down on those crucial points.
I mean, how do you see playing people into those sorts of formats? What do you want to do? Do you go in with a view of we'll do these and we won't do these, or... do you think about that? Or do you just want to say, actually, yeah, we're ahead, we'll just keep it with the pictures and do minimal exposure?
So I'd say, firstly, the actual debates and much of them unwind to have very little relevance in of themselves. I think the media have far more excitement and focus because it's themselves. It's get a chance to talk about themselves and something they are doing From a campaign point of view, it is another conduit where we can tell our message. Mm. So again, it's all just about the framing and there'll be some eyeballs. But in and of themselves, they're not this centrepiece of a campaign that we're all worried about. I'm worried about the message. So if Boris is on TV, if Boris is on, you know, the radio, if he's going to interview in a newspaper, if we're doing a social media clip, where's the message? If the message isn't there, we're failing. That's all I care about. So it's just another conduit to a message. Now, you look for advantages. You know, we do things, for example, that, you know, if we saw the 10, we would have somebody totting up the amount of minutes that the Labour Party had on the 10 compared to what we did, who was top of the 10, just to use as an argumentative tool so I can ring Kate and say, over the last, here's a report that we've done over the last fortnight showing that you've actually given the Labour Party 15 minutes more airtime and they've tended to be top X amounts, just in the hope of just nudging them to our that sort of undercurrent of pressure constantly. But it's all just about delivering the message. I don't really care too much about the actual debate itself. It's just
Do you care about debates? Did Labour, in the campaigns you're in, did they care about giving Jeremy Corbyn the opportunity to make his case in debates?
Yes, of course. And our main thing was always, how can we get Jeremy to be able to speak unfiltered in his own voice? And when he did, it was effective. And I think that the debates should be mandatory. I think there should be some kind of agreement that they do happen. I don't think doing an interview with Andrew Neil should be part of the British Constitution, but I do think...
sorry, Andrew, if you're watching.
Sorry,
Andrew disagrees.
Yes, sorry.
With Adam Bolton,
Although some people really... Anyway, I won't go into that. But I do think the debates are important and they should exist. Of course, you know, Lee was skillfully dancing around it, but his main point is correct. You try to take any tactical advantage from any particular moment. So take the seven headers, as Katie says, they're way more light than noise or heat than whatever it is. Yeah. They're not very good to watch. Yeah. Not much comes out of them. But we still got a lot of coverage in 2017 about Jeremy going at the last minute. So more people knew that he'd gone and that Theresa May hadn't than watch the actual thing, which wasn't very interesting.
Do you think those things actually shape voting intention? Do you think people actually vote because they've seen a debate? Do you think it changes minds?
I think it can do. I think, there's much more evidence gathered in the US because they've been doing it for many, many years, and the social scientific evidence suggests that it's got some impact. But, you have to consider in both campaigns where we started, which was 20 points behind. And no one has ever increased that much before. And the 2017 campaign is the largest increase of a party, a popular vote in polling in such a short period of time. And in 2019, we were on the same trajectory for the first, let's say, 3 weeks of the campaign, the same upward climb. And then we were effectively plateaued. We were desperately hoping that Donald Trump would help us out and come and say something very stupid, but you made him very disciplined.
Well, Liz Truss, of course, wanted to... She was trying to kill the Get Brexit Done narrative. She didn't want it, and that was a slogan. It should have been that we were going to get a great trade deal with America is what she wanted to do for that election. she called me up.
How things could have been different.
She called me up. She called Azza Levida up and Dominic Cummings as well and said, we've got it wrong with Get Brexit Done. We must pivot to the great trade deal we're going to get with America, which obviously we pointed out that, firstly, you know, we're probably not going to get one this side of the election. Trump probably won't do us any favours.
You've been secretly doing it for four rounds of talks with the NHS on the table.
And of course, right, James would have framed the whole thing about the Tories selling the NHS to Trump, which is the worst imaginable framing of that election. And again, that's what, you know, when you talk about moral stories and how you're framing things, it shows why it's so critical. Because I think if Liz is leading that 2019 election and that's the framing, Jeremy Corbyn's now Prime Minister.
Mm. So, Lee, what is... you're running election comms strategy, but Boris Johnson was also Prime Minister. I mean, you had the sort of... I think it was NATO summit that Trump was over for or something. Yeah. Trump came in. You know, how are you... You might have a crisis. How are you actually thinking about running the election comms strategy aside from being the sort of Prime Minister's... Yeah, whatever. Is it an opportunity to show, look, prime ministerial at things, or does it mean you've actually got to be dealing with the day job?
I mean, it's exhausting. That's the first thing I'd say. I mean, I think those things could be incredibly challenging while they're sort of running concurrently. And, you know, mostly we needed Trump to be out of the equation for that. And I think there was a good diplomatic job done to remove him from that. But, you know, we also had to deal with live issues, like there was a terrorist attack in 2019. And I think, you know, your first paramount, you know, your first responsibility is, you know, the safety of the nation and dealing with that responsibly. But you do also think of it within a political realm too. And we saw the amount of damage it did to Theresa May in 2017, which didn't handle that particularly well. We need to show that there was a certain amount of grip and to show that leadership in a core moment. So, you know, if you look at, say, at the moment with Rishi Sunak, I think it's interesting that he seems to have delegated the entire sort of geopolitical realm to David Cameron. And quite often, David Cameron looks like he's the Prime Minister. It's a very odd dynamic. And, you know, that I think is fine if you've got a great domestic policy and you're trying to tell a great domestic story. But that seems to be slightly absent. So, you know, it's given opportunity. There's a missed opportunity there to be. Yeah.
But is he worried? I mean, I've seen that and ambassadors have said to me, we think this is really bad, that it's always David Cameron and not Rishi Sunak. But I was with David Cameron in Uzbekistan last week or the week before. I think the week before. And I was wondering about it. And then I thought, it's not a great narrative for Rishi Sunak right now when things are as they are in the UK to be in Uzbekistan.
I mean, I think you always have to have a powerful domestic story. I imagine, you know, if Boris was PM, I couldn't imagine him abdicating, you know, responsibility in Ukraine, for example, certainly not to David Cameron. But, but you know, I think you just wanted, there's an advantage there of showing yourself as a leader, as a serious player on the global stage. I think, you know, that's not going to win you a huge amount of votes in itself. You need to have that, you know, powerful framing.
Can I just say one quick thing on the, you know, you're talking about like, how much a difference the campaign makes, how much difference debates make. Obviously, 2017 is really unusual in the change that you got during the campaign. But one thing that people always say to me is that people don't really pay attention until the final few weeks. I mean, I was thinking, I was sitting with a loved one, I won't say who, to embarrass them, after they'd voted in the London mayoral election, and watching the TV, and they went, who's Susan Hall? And I was like, and this is a very politically engaged person, and I was like, what? Who's Susan Hall? The Conservative candidate. But it just suddenly made me think, and somebody in the Labour side said to me, you know, everyone sees it as a negative that they've not got their policies all kind of lined up at the moment. They see that as message discipline, because as someone said to me, Keir Starmer could have, and this is his view, not this is another person's view, not mine, Keir Starmer could have policies tattooed across his chest. People are not yet paying attention, and they want to save that moment till later.
But Nanushka, one of the things you do during elections and in the run-up to elections is get politicians to sort of rule things out that basically almost ought to be optional. Will you keep the triple lock? Will you put up any of the sort of major taxes and stuff like that? Do you ever sort of worry that you're doing the nation a bit of a disservice by forcing politicians to take things off the table? But basically,
it's up to them to take them off the table. They don't have to take them off the table. It is up to them to allow themselves wriggle room when they get in. And it's up to them to have a campaign otherwise. I actually think the flip is true. Right. And I was talking about the 2015 thing. Like, David Cameron would not say where he was getting money for particular changes, including to the NHS. And I actually thought it was a disservice to the country that you could go into an election campaign dodging questions about the importance of those things. I think it is that the reason Labour are doing that at the moment is because they are absolutely convinced that if they leave any wriggle room whatsoever in terms of their kind of fiscal responsibility, that will be very, very damaging in terms of an election campaign. But that is their choice. And in doing so, they clearly have made things difficult for them immediately after the election. And I think John Curtis was making this point. You've got a huge lead now. You've made it harder to maintain that lead in the months after an election.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And, a couple of points, I think, on Anushka's, I absolutely agree. And Lee and James will know more about how you roll out the message to me, but I do think there's a flip side danger in the fact, particularly for Labour, is that they obviously stand for what, and that continues to be a problem, which has been, you know, a narrative for some time. And I'd be interested to see how, as the timetable shortens to the inevitable vote, how they actually do that, because they absolutely have to come out and do that. I think that's right. I was going to mention social media.
We've got lots of questions about reaching, about, you know, young people only getting their information through social media, decline of whatever.
I just wanted to make a point about the campaign, really, is that I think we touched on it a little bit earlier, is that There was a period through 19 particularly where I felt that social media and the politicians had such a direct relationship that the story and to an extent the policy was changing in relationship between those two things. And there was a couple of days particularly, I mean, the punch was one, but there was another, it was a Labour story, and how, you know, that the policies and the narrative of the media were directly related to the noise on social media. And I think that, you know, it's something that the broadcasters really, really need to watch out for. And of course, the thing that we haven't mentioned is the great kind of AI fake news threat, which is going to be, I think, you know, an issue. I don't think, by the way, that it's going to, you know, really cause, you know, the world to fall apart. But I do think it will get in the way of the campaign. And the broadcasters absolutely are going to have to fix anything early. I'm not sure they're equipped to do that yet. And be, you know, really, really be on top of what they're actually saying in verification terms.
Can I just come in very quickly on the punch that wasn't? Because I agree with your the general point that you made about social media. But in that particular case, the punch that wasn't, it wasn't about social media at all. It was someone from the Conservative campaign briefing journalists, including Laura Koonsberg and the most senior journalists in the country, who then tweeted, which is their job. They reported a thing that wasn't true, including saying there were grim scenes when there were no scenes because there was no punch, which then created a social media thing, which then the broadcast had followed. So that wasn't a failure of, I mean, that may have been a failure subsequently of continuing to follow a story because it had social media coverage, but actually the failure there was entirely in the relationship between the Conservative person who briefed it and the journalist who reported it.
I should correct on that because, sorry, you go first.
No, I was going to say, in defence of Laura in this situation, I think gets a lot of heat for some of these things. You know, that the whole issue was entirely our mistake, entirely our fault, where someone on the ground says, you know, this has happened, this, you know, we were there, they've got bad intel, they've over-elevated an issue that they shouldn't have done. It comes to us, everyone's very excited in the battle of a campaign. We briefed it out without checking quick enough. There was a couple of sources, you know, we apologise to the BBC and to Laura because of that, because we've got it wrong. I understand James's point, I can see the frustration, but I think there's a lot of trust that goes in with these conversations. And, you know, if I tell something, Katie, that isn't true, or Laura, whoever it is, next time they're going to believe me a little less, but mistakes do happen in those times.
Exactly that, and to jump on that, because it sounds like the BBC took something from the...
Not only the BBC, I mean, everyone.
Actually, it was in the noise of it. I'm making a general point, because actually, although I get your general position, actually it was the social media noise that grew it, and the BBC had it double-sourced from two different people. So, and we can talk about how that happened another time, but, you know, there was a kind of journalistic conversation around. It wasn't just like, thanks very much, we'll tweet that out. It was absolutely about the noise of the campaign.
Okay, I want to leave the punch where it is.
Yes.
The punch that wasn't is now the punch that isn't. So let's go to some questions in the room. And if anyone's next door, put your head round. So lady there and then lady over there. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. And if you can just tell us who you are and quick questions so we can get lots in.
Hi, I'm Lucy Dargahi. I work at Parliament. Do you think that, and this is a question to all the panel, do you think that media coverage of officials behind the campaign are fair game? I know, Lee, you've had this a lot. James, you've had this a lot. Dominic Cummings had it a lot. There was a big profile piece on Morgan McSweeney yesterday. What do you think about that? Thanks.
Okay, we'll pop that there and then over there.
Thank you. Grace Duffy from Bridges Outcomes Partnerships. I'm interested in the panel's views on nuance and honesty in the sort of execution and coverage of election campaigns and the kind of consequences of any lack thereof.
And are you thinking of anything particular you'd like to go in?
I had been working on the Brexit negotiations, so I did find a lot of the 2019 campaign quite surprisingly inaccurate, but also thinking about some of the tough choices ahead for whoever is the next election, what lessons are being learned from Theresa May and the care comms especially.
Okay, take those two questions. I'll come back again if anyone else has got a question. Let's go to this question first. Anushka, I mean, you know, are we too interested in the back room now? Some of these people, I think it's a big profile by Tom McTague of Morgan McSweeney today as the sort of, you know, person behind the Starmer project or whatever. I mean, should we be interested in these people?
I mean, 100% we should be interested in them because they're really important to the thinking of what happens. And actually understanding them
is, you know, almost more important sometimes than understanding the people who are fronting the campaign. I mean, I'm writing a book on the next election, and I tell you what, there are plenty of behind-the-scenes people who I'm very keen to talk to, perhaps more than some of the people in front of them. Are they fair game? I think that sometimes they can be turned into bogeymen or bogeywomen. I think mainly bogeymen, actually. And I do sometimes think that the coverage of them can become quite unfair in those situations. I can think of potential bogeymen behind both of your campaigns who, you know, in fact, you mentioned Dominic Cummings. I think Seamus Milne was another person. And the impression your average person would have of both of them, I don't think is actually completely representative of who they are. And I say, I mean, I don't think I've ever, you know, I don't think it's like a deliberate thing in each thing, but I think that's what you have to be a little bit careful of. These are just kind of normal people working for campaigns, and no doubt they make mistakes, and no doubt they try to manipulate us day in, day out. But I think that if we are covering them, which I think we should cover them in a fair way.
I think we're probably, people like us in this room, are more interested in them than the general public. Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely worth knowing about because they're shaping the policies of our country. But I think most voters won't really care or know who they are particularly.
Are you worried about being spotted to deter people who decided not to get elected? They decided to be behind the scenes to...
I don't think that's either here nor there. That's not really one of the structural problems with our politics, of which there are many. I think fair game, I wouldn't put it that way, because that implies that you've got a wide number of people who are available for the kind of personal intrusion that comes with public life. But take that Tom McTague piece. Tom McTague is, I would say, one of the few journalists who... takes his subject seriously on their own terms, and I think took us seriously on our own terms. And I think the Morgan McSweeney piece is very good, and it's very interesting, and doesn't ever cross the line into, intrusion into the privacy of someone that isn't a public-facing person, but is important in understanding what that project is. So I think that's the line you have to cross.
I mean, Lee, you probably got this more than many. Dominic Cummings became quite a notorious, well-known, recognised figure in his own right. Don't know whether he thought that was what he was signing up for. How's it feel? Do you think you're fair game?
I think there's a couple of things with this. I think, firstly, the media always quite enjoy focusing on the next kind of Rasputin. They've seen all of the characters at the front of the play and kind of, who's new, who's interesting. Mm. Is there a relevance in talking about, my time there? Dominic Cummings did make a difference to the decisions of the government. You know, his ideological views and policy positions mattered. So I understand, the need to cover those and look at those from an intellectual perspective. Did we need cameras outside his house every day? People basically showing where he lived, someone getting, death threats and those sorts of things. People, we were trying to, may not agree with them, but it's people trying to do something in political, guys. I would argue no, and I think there's no merit for doorsteps, particularly if a doorstep, which I think I've got totally out of control because they're fundamentally content. It's an easy way to get a clip. That's what they are, and I think there should be a responsibility from broadcasters to take that out of the equation. If a politician who is elected A has done something wrong and is refusing to answer questions on that, then, a doorstep is a perfectly acceptable way to face the electorate. If it's just, we need a clip to go at the top of the 10 about something we find quite titillating, so we'll stick cameras outside Dominic Cummings or whoever else it may be, every day, I think that's a totally different thing, and that shouldn't be allowed.
I also think that extends to politicians. I mean, Jeremy was hounded, disgracefully hounded, almost every day outside of his home. It was photographed. Everybody knows where he lives. This is someone who had a far-right terrorist who plotted to kill him, who was punched in the head in a public meeting, who, of course, has had death threats and so on and so forth. And the way in which a lot of the media operates in those types of things is completely disproportionate to the news gathering value, especially when these people are not difficult to get interviews from.
So, Katie, just a quick comment on whether you sort of feel, whether you send people to people's houses, whether you feel guilty if you do, in the light of what James and Lee have said, particularly if they're not elected. But I wanted you to come in on the nuance question here. I mean, do you think that the coverage actually really told people what was at stake and managed to get beyond? You know, James has given a fantastic interview where he talks about Boris Johnson's discipline of just saying, get Brexit done, get Brexit done, get Brexit. You know, did we actually manage to expose what lay beneath that at all at any point in the 2019 election? Or did the coverage
is there really
that?
A question about Brexit? I mean, on the first point, I think, I mean, I completely have some sympathy with both Lee and James's view. But I feel slightly hypocritical say that because, you know, I'd absolutely be sending cameras kind of everywhere I could. You know, I think there's a problem in that actually, you know, and this sounds like an excuse, I really don't mean it as one, but the whole of the media operates like that. So unless all of the media got together and agreed that we weren't going to do that, then you're in a competitive loss if you're not part of that conversation. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, questions to ask, I don't think I'm quite as far as Lee is in terms of scrutiny on people. I do think, you know, particularly, although I completely get the point about Cummings in terms of and Jeremy Corbyn about the safety issues, I think particularly with Dominic, he'd got himself into a position where he was so important to the debate that, you know, particularly around the Barncastle period where it was particularly intense, you know, it was difficult not to. But I do think there's a sympathy around that. And I, you know, broadcasters do think about sending, but there I suspect different to a few years back, there's much more sort of trigger-happy sort of tendency to send them on. On Brexit, you know, God, this is a, you know, a whole separate session I think we could do. You know, did we get it all right? Did all of the media get it all right? No, we didn't. Of course we didn't. And we've said that many, there's been, you know, hundreds of books written and thousands of pages written on that. Did we try to do a you know, fair coverage? Yes, of course we would. You'd expect me to say that. I think hindsight is a wonderful thing. I do think that Brexit was very different to an election. And, you know, I know for me, if I was starting again, I think I'd have more experienced glasses on about how we both got around the country, but also reflected all those different positions on policy. But, you know, we gave it a shot and people can write subsequently.
Anushka, how do you think? So, I mean, in the election particularly, which was a Brexit election, even if 2017 wasn't a Brexit election.
I mean, it really depends where you are. So, you know, I was policy editor on The Observer. I'll tell you what, I would have got into every single nuance that you're talking about and have had the space to write about it. Now I make pieces for ITV News that are probably 2 minute 15, 2 minutes 30 long. You're going to, you know, 3.5 million at evening news. They're probably putting their kids to bed or making tea while they're watching. You're trying to basically choose what bits to put into this. You don't have the space to do that detail. We try to do it with lives afterwards. And I always think that we should reflect them. You know, even if you can't go into every bit of detail, you can reflect the nuance of the debate. I mean, when you look back at, you know, an example of us really, really messing up on Brexit, and I think this was the campaigns and the journalists, was not to focus more on Northern Ireland during the actual campaign. I mean, I will always look back on that and just think, I think it's like 1% of coverage or something, which seems completely insane in hindsight. But I think it is the trickiness of, so what I will always try and do, I like getting into a lot of the detail. I'll try and use a blog to get some of that stuff out if I can't get it onto the news that night. But I do think it is our responsibility, and I hope I'm going to be, have a pretty high profile role at ITV News in this election campaign. However much it may not always be the thing that everybody wants to listen to focus on the issues and the solutions and what you will actually get if these guys get elected.
OK, let's go for a very quick question, and I've got sort of one or two summing up. Let's try and do... There are four people, so let's do everybody. There.
Hi, Bénédicte Pavieux, France 24, a reporter in French and English around the world. I can tell you that me and my colleagues, Barnard Castle, Partygate, Dominic Cummings, and all kinds of scandals were internationally covered and are internationally famous, and of course have affected the perception of the United Kingdom across the world. But I wonder how much that lack of trust, and if I had money for every time somebody, when we're out and about, says to me that politicians, all politicians, are liar, and I find myself almost in a situation of defending politicians, how does that lack of trust complicate things for the next general election coverage?
Thank you. Benedict, could you hand it to the man next to you? Super efficiently, yes.
Hi, I'm Tom Callan-Riley from the fact-checking charity Full Fact. And so kind of linked to this question is how the campaigns respond to requests to correct the record, or a kind of how important accuracy is and honesty and transparency is compared to the kind of good messaging, and how, if something is found to be inaccurate, how to kind of intervene in the campaign.
Brilliant, thank you. And then back there. Yes, and I think there was one more person. Yes.
Hi, Charlie Rogers, Research and Insights Analyst at Stonehaven. Anushka, you mentioned that broadcasters have to be careful in terms of being led by the polls and how much that happens throughout the course of the election. For the parties themselves, how much should they be responding to public opinion research, the focus groups, the polls during an election campaign versus sticking with the messages contained within the policy manifesto?
Brilliant question. And was there a final question? Yes.
Hi. In today's Sahil Shah, Say No to Disinfo. In today's digital age, what role does data play in a communication strategy, and what would be considered both ethical and effective ways of collecting data? And in light of that, what tools from the field of psychology and especially psychological manipulation are used within communication strategies in elections?
Okay, a fantastic set of questions. I'm going to map them into a sort of final set of questions about actually what's going to be different this time round. You know, how might you counter the loss of trust, whatever? Where are the media now? We've seen the rise of sort of some explainer journalism, the sort of Ross Atkins videos, you know, fact-checking, which we started, whatever there. And I'm sort of interested in these questions as well about how the campaigns, and in particular, you know, different bits of the campaigns will be driven by polling and data. Anushka, in case you need to rush out, you know, what's sort of different this time round? How are you going to address some of these things around nobody, every switch off, and also potentially two candidates who aren't as good campaigners, possibly, as the ones we saw in 2019?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is the individual, have we? Yeah. The individual is so important. And actually, I heard Neil Kinnock say this recently, and I felt this very strongly about Ed Miliband. If the public doesn't want you to be prime minister, then probably you're not going to be prime minister, sort of regardless of how good the overall campaign is. I think in this situation, Keir Starmer has an issue because he's sort of seen as quite boring, but actually he doesn't scare people, so I don't think he's going to have the problem that Ed Miliband had. Just on that lack of trust, it is so depressing, the place that we have got to. I do data on Peston, and I had some data recently that said 9% of people trust what politicians say, and I think it is so damaging for us as a society that we have reached this stage. And I know journalists are trusted only just a little bit more than that, so we can't speak about it either. I mean, I recently made two documentaries for ITV on Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, sort of to set off the election year. And we had incredible access to both of them, lots of behind the scenes stuff. And I think felt we did, hold them to account on policy within those. But it was also about trying to get to know the individuals better and to show a different side of them and to show what maybe their friends or their family might see of them. And it is interesting. And they both went down really well, and it was a great thing to do. But equally, what I found with the coverage, I mean, I knew it before I even did it, almost like put my hard hat on. People don't want to see politicians as humans anymore. They don't want to know about who they are, or they just don't trust their motivations anymore. And I think to some extent that is come from things that they have done over the past 10 years. And to some extent it's come to just the way society has changed. It's probably to do with social media. I feel like we really need to try and address it and change it, because, you know, I just find it so damaging. I don't know, should Labour win the next election with a strong majority? Does it just sort of, do we start to enter a new phase where it doesn't feel so vicious and so negative? But I do think it is really bad for society, for campaigns, and just, yeah, for the kind of general health of our democracy.
Katie, would you like to pick up the question about, you know, fact-checking, challenging things, and what do you see your role as making sure that people don't get away with wrong claims.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's been, you know, an enormous growth, of course, in line with fake news over the last few years, and I think this election will be there. So, full fact. I was having a discussion about fact check yesterday. There's reality check. Mm. There's BBC Verify. There's, you know, the list goes on. And so, I think there'll be a huge growth in that. The one thing I would say, actually, and I can say this now that I'm out of the BBC, is that I think it's really important that all of these groups and data people call it much more, which is really difficult. And I, you know, and I understand from the BBC perspective, there was always an issue in really, really stepping over the line to say, no, this is what we think. And we understand in terms of the balance why that happens. But I would say, you know, in terms, again, of serving the audience, giving some clarity, what depresses me when I read stuff is I think I look at it and think, well, on one hand, on the other, well, only time will tell. You know, pointless, no point in reading that. Tell me what the actual call-in is on what we think, whether it's a manifesto commitment or whether it's an argument in the campaign.
So it's fine to do a sort of post-match fact-check. But do you think your presenters are skilled and informed enough to challenge sort of in real time when someone's making a... There was a notorious interview between Evan Davis and Laura Trott, who tied herself in knots trying to defend the fiscal rules.
Although the next day the BBC had to back up a little bit on that, actually, because she wasn't entirely wrong. They were talking about different definitions.
Well, but she was wrong on what the government's fiscal rule was, which was what everyone was trying to tell
her. It's a brave woman who takes Evan Davis on over the economy. I've got to say that.
Yeah, that was a bit of a dumb outing,
unless
anyway,
you know, you're really on it. So, yeah, look, I mean, absolutely right. Of course, there would be presenters who are not equipped to do that at all, but I would hope that, you know, if the programme's like Anoushka, and delivers for, and so a lot of the main BBC ones and Sky and all the rest, is there's going to be a number of very, very high-profile people who are going to end up doing the key interviews, and let's hope they're equipped for it.
OK. So, you two, I mean, what's going to be different about the campaigns this time round if you were being called in to sort of advise, or sort of, you know, how far should they be driven by polling? How should they be using data and psychological insights? James.
I think the odds of me being called in to advise are incredibly slim.
So all and those people sitting in Labour HQ will only hear it here from you. So
they can pay me lots of money and I'll be happy. Can I address the lack of trust?
Yeah, address the lack of trust as well.
Because I think we're in danger here, and I'm going to make myself very unpopular probably in this particular room, but we're in danger of blaming the public for the fact that 9% trust politicians, 12% according to the Office of National Statistics last year say that they trust a political party. And we are in a situation where our political and media class cannot see why they are hated. And they are, I'm afraid, rightfully hated, especially if you look at questions of honesty. We have a political class that lies and lies and lies. Keir Starmer, for example, is a documented liar, so is Boris Johnson, and so on and so forth. Often you, and this is why people think this. They don't think this because people like me have soapboxes and we tell people this. This is what people's actual experience is, because they can see them say one thing one day and then something completely different the next day. And social media shows you this much more, because you can have side-by-side videos of someone saying, I support this thing, and then the next day saying, I really do not support whatever this thing is, and their reasons for it are always nonsense. So if we do want to have greater respect and so on, then you're going to need to have much larger overhaul of our democratic system, rather than hoping that things will change because politics will somehow stabilise. Politics, even with a large Labour majority, is not going to stabilise in this country, because the underlying conditions are very, very bad for a very large number of people and show no sign of getting any better. The reason why we have political volatility is because we are in a deep social and economic crisis that there is, which has many larger than Britain elements to it. We can see that in geopolitics, in the climate breakdown, and those things are not going to go away. So if we're interested in having trust and integrity in politics, mumbling on about the so-called Nolan principles and integrity in public life and all of this stuff, which these people that lie day in and day out talk about. Instead, we need to find ways to have democratic accountability over the people that rule us.
Okay, Lee.
I mean, just on that point as well, I think it's fundamentally, you know, it's quite simple. Deliver what you're promising to the public. So, you know, we've got And if you look at Rishi Sunak, he said, I'm going to stop the boats. He's not going to stop the boats. Rwanda's the nonsense. It's not going to be delivered. And the public, immigration's a huge concern. We don't deliver on it. So again, you raise the salience, which is also a bad campaigning. Mm. You raise the salience an issue you're not going to solve. Waiting lists down. I think at one point they said we're going to have the waiting list down the NHS. As you see, people's real life experience is appalling in the NHS. Mm. So again, what we need to fix these problems. It's very well talking about them and elevating them in the campaign setting. But if you're not actually solving the issues, people lose faith. I think, we look at it from a media point of view. If you look at the local elections coverage this weekend, I think you would actively be less informed about things if you watch the media this weekend. I think it was terrible coverage. And it's everyone's interest now to talk about, there might be a hung parliament. There's not going to be a hung parliament.
We literally said there's not going to be a hung parliament.
But I mean, the broad coverage overall was there's a lot of excitement.
Actually led by Rishi Sunak saying there's going to be a hung parliament, the fact that his own data says
no, that was led by Sky News with a rather dubious professor saying that, I've done a really dodgy poll and it's going to be a hung parliament.
ITV News,
the average MRP will say.
We're not getting into the. So, Adam, no one can hear you online, so...
But there's not going to be a hung parliament, Adam.
He said there was going to be a hung parliament. He said, on the basis of the votes cast, if you do an exercise, this could be the result. That is totally legitimate.
The strap was government heading for a hung parliament.
I think there's a really interesting thing about these projected national vote shares off local elections when we know everybody votes differently in local elections. But anyway, Lee, but surely, get Brexit done, very simplistic slogan. I just wrote a report saying Brexit's still not done. There's loads of loose ends. It's, whatever. We're living with the consequences. Lots of the promises in Brexit, were not just not delivered, but surely not deliverable. Don't you think you need to take a bit of responsibility for the sort of lack of trust that Benedict's just pointing out?
I think if you look at where people's lack of trust is, again, if you look at people's concerns, it's NHS, again, it's immigration, it's long-standing issues that aren't delivered on. And when we looked at, this is the problem. The people in this room have a total disconnect with the general public. And this is why, the more people... The more people look through, research, and I think when we come through to messaging, and this I think is the core point, and we talk about how much people engage with what's particularly happening, you have sort of 0.004% of people sort of will take in information that is presented to them on a daily basis. Most of it is ignored. So this is why we do the messaging that we do, is there's a sort of rational ignorance for people because it's too much to consume. So you have to create simple moral stories that people will understand and digest in. So all the tenets of the political campaigns that I'm part of, you look at prioritisation, simplification, repetition. What areas of the issues of the day we look to prioritise, how we look to frame that. Simplification of what messages do we wish to, portray in a very simple way so you're not alienating people with language that's too complex. And then repetition, get out and put those messages through time and time again, because that is fundamentally allowing people to hear what you're trying to say.
Okay,
I've got to run for a BNP.
No, you've got to run.
Just one point on the thing James said. I've been doing this since 2003, people in this room longer than that. Politicians have lied throughout that entire period. So it's not a case that is the thing that has changed. And there are times where Jeremy Corbyn lied as well. It is not the case, but I agree with you that the underlying situation and the economy has changed. But I don't think that in itself explains the loss of trust. I think it is a series of major events and a kind of social crisis, as you say, that has changed things. But politicians behave then as they do now. I think the things around it have changed.
OK, we're going to leave Anoushka
with
the last word
there.
Thank you, Anoushka. And having completely lost control of that discussion there. but I think very interesting, because I think it's a really interesting tension that Lee has just revealed between simplifying and actually the complexity of delivering some of these things. And maybe that's irresoluble, but we do need to find some way of addressing the issues there. I'm sorry, it didn't come to polling and data and psychological insights. That maybe for more events. There was an IFG event a couple of weeks ago on how do we raise ethical standards in public life. So do go back to that if you think that's something where we can have some actions. But before we do that, just remind you, if you want to rewatch this, it's on our website. Thanks everybody to watching online. There are upcoming IFG events next week for people interested in Parliament. Lucy Powell coming to give a speech on how Labour would work with Parliament. And the next day, an event on Parliament and regulation with Dame Meg Hillier and Sir Robert Buckland. Honours are proliferating these days. But without further ado, could you just say thank you to my bizarrely untitled panel?